This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Green.
The independent autopsy on Nolan Wells came back undetermined. The pathologist listed seven questions he still can't answer and said he cannot rule out foul play. The DA committed to presenting this to a grand jury once the investigation is complete. But what does that grand jury and what that grand jury actually receives depends on decisions being made right now. That's what we're going to be getting into today. Your thoughts in the comment section and Substack and YouTube. Robin Dreek, retired FBI special agent, chief of the counterintelligence behavioral analysis program, with us as always. And joining us, from what we understand, I'm not making this up, this sounds like something I would pull out of my ass, Jennifer Coffendaffer is joining us from a train in Czechoslovakia. That's a new one. Never thought I'd have that. Jen, welcome. We don't have a visual on her today, but we have her audio if you're watching us on YouTube to talk about this case. So I'm just going to jump into the case. What is going on in the investigation right now behind the scenes as they prepare to present this information to a grand jury? I want to take an opinion out of this, not whether we think anything happened, foul play or not, but if they're preparing information to present to a grand jury, what are they putting together right now, and how long might it take to get that to a grand jury and for an investigation to take once it's handed off? Jen, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think this is going to take quite a while, and I'll tell you why. It's because they're going to want to go through all the digital information from his phone and from all the friends' phone. We found out that there were about 30 friends that actually went on three separate boats. Well, that's a lot of people to go ahead and get that information about, not to mention all of the witnesses. That's going to include more than just the buddies. That's also going to include everyone potentially that was on that beach. So I see this taking quite a while, and this should all be presented to the grand jury with, of course, the GPS information, the autopsy information. Those are the big ticket items.
The grand jury has subpoena power. Obviously, investigators have so much power, too. But what sort of powers does the grand jury have in this case that maybe investigators don't have yet? Is the investigation going to get so far and then start relying on the powers of the grand jury that may go beyond the scope of what they're able to do right now?
Well, no. The grand jury won't have any more powers than the investigators have, but they're dual powers. In other words, you can issue subpoenas through the grand jury, and you can also do subpoenas and get information through warrants and things like that. So you're able to get the same information. It's just through a different avenue.
Is one more difficult to exercise than the other as far as an investigator going to a court, getting a subpoena versus a grand jury requesting it because they're the grand jury and it's they want it, they get it, basically? I'm just wondering if the lever is easier to pull in one direction or the other when people are trying to dig, especially if you have reluctant witnesses. And again, not to say anything criminal, but because of the way that this case has been going and people not wanting to have their name, you know, in the mix of all the minutiae here and the very high emotions that are flying.
The lever is much easier to pull when it comes to a grand jury subpoena. Mm-hmm. That is a piece of cake comparatively. It's much quicker than, say, a warrant. Mm-hmm. So it is a strong investigative body that has quicker powers to utilize. So that's another reason that a grand jury is a good course of action in this case.
And Jen, how soon do you think, or the speed of moving from a grand jury to the investigation would it go? Because, I mean, I think there's enough here, both with public sentiment and inaccuracies and just the typically way these things work, that it should move away from the grand jury at some point. I mean, I haven't worked with grand juries on my counterintelligence side. How fast does that process happen?
Well, I think this is going to be a slow one, and I'll tell you why. It's likely that they'll put these witnesses before the grand jury. They don't have to do it that way. They could have the detective that interviews them come and deliver the totality of what each witness had to say. However, consider this. These grand jurors are like having 15 to 24, I believe it is, in Mississippi, super sleuths sitting there. Not all of them, but they're going to be very inquisitive. They're going to want to do a good job. And it's terrible. It's like having 24 defense attorneys coming at you. So if they want to hear from these witnesses, they're going to be able to do that. Can you imagine how long that's going to make the process?
Yeah. And in the cases you've worked in the past, how long does that process take from, well, typically, if so, say they got, I mean, do they really need that many people to say that something's a little off? Are they going to want to interview everyone? In other words, because I know, like, when in my investigations, when we were working them in the Bureau, you know, it wasn't a huge high bar for me to move from a preliminary investigation into a full investigation. So I'm kind of, is it the same thing here? Is it kind of the grand jury is kind of like a PI, a preliminary investigation before the full, or is it something different?
Well, it's a full right now, definitely a full in terms of how it's being constructed and put together. The question that I think you're definitely trying to get to is how long in the world is this going to take? And a lot of it is going to depend on that grand jury, what they are satisfied with in terms of the evidence. If they don't believe that the detective, as an example, is presenting the witness statements to their satisfaction, they're going to want to hear possibly from some of those witnesses. So it just depends on what they want.
And is that what the grand jurors themselves are going to be requesting, or is that what the attorneys are going to want, or the judge that's overseeing it?
Well, so the prosecutor and the clerk, they're the only people in there other than the witness and the grand jurors. So okay. A judge won't have any idea what's going on in this case. It will just be those individuals. And the prosecutor has an idea of how he wants to present this to the grand jurors. And he can present it as it comes in. That's what my experience has been. In other words, if you have a return of the subpoena, you don't wait around. You return them. You return it right when you get the what we call a subpoena return. Mm-hmm. So if they do it like that, it should be going along as we speak. In other words, it's piecemealed in. And then ultimately, prosecutor will ask, listen, I want you to consider this for whether there are charges that should be levied or whether they're not. And that's when you're looking at whether a true bill or a no bill would be returned or a nothing bill. Mm-hmm. A lot of people think that you always have a true or a nothing bill, but sometimes it just goes before the grand jury and there's nothing there. So the prosecutor doesn't have anybody to ask for probable cause against. That's the third area that is seldom discussed.
So basically it's the entire thing is determined by the prosecutor. He's the one that's going to be, he or she's going to be the one listening to the grand jurors and listening to the evidence that they're presenting. So they're going to be the ones making the final call.
No, the grand jurors make the final call. The prosecutor
themselves.
Strictly decides who he's going to put on and so forth, but the grand jurors can ask. In other words, we need to hear from this witness, or what about this phone, or this wasn't enough, why didn't you go back further, or whatever the case may be, and then the prosecutor has to go back and get that from the detective.
Thanks for explaining that.
Let me ask you this, because we've been talking about people having reasons to not want to cooperate at this moment in time, or maybe just holding back their cell phones from being examined, not because there's anything to hide on there in terms of anything that happened to Nolan Wells, but because they're 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, some 21-year-old people who may be involved in activities that are not necessarily legal. Per se, drinking, drugs, who knows what else, and conversations that may be not wanting to have someone else to see, or somebody doesn't want their pictures being seen on their phone by investigators. There's a lot of individual reasons why a lot of people may not want to give their phones over to authorities to investigate. Obviously, if you're a friend here, you want the truth to come out, but people have their individual reasons of not wanting to be caught at whatever they're doing. If if their phones are subpoenaed, what sort of fear, if any, is grounded in those folks of giving their phones over? Would investigators have any leverage to look at other things on those devices and go after them for completely unrelated charges just because they caught it on their phone? Or if when they're giving their devices over for investigation, are they limited to strictly finding information related to Nolan Wells' disappearance?
No, the answer is no. And I'll tell you, I just asked Mr. Proctor about that. I'm referring to the Karen Reed case.
Yeah.
And I only bring that up because I'm very serious that when you have an investigation like this, and if something else comes out, in other words, you're the biggest drug dealer in the county, they can act on that because they had the authority to look at that phone.
Yeah. So you're playing the odds there. I mean, if you're the biggest drug dealer in the county, yeah, they could probably come down to you. But if it's just, I guess there really is no bar. It's all a gray area. If there is a picture of you drinking and you're underage, if there's a picture of you smoking weed or something, I don't know if it's legal in Mississippi or whatever the hell someone might be doing that may fall under illegal terms. Would they really be going after people for that sort of thing, do you think? It's a you think question. And if you're the kid, I don't know that you're willing to roll the dice there if you know damn well, you know, you don't have anything that's of criminal nature regarding Nolan Wells on there. But maybe you got a video of him on the island and you don't even know it. I mean, that's some dice that they may have some issues with being rolled.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. That's why these things are very sticky, Tony, because when you look at it, people want their privacy protected.
Yeah.
They do not want to have to give up information that could possibly incriminate them for something, you know, that has nothing to do with this case. So I think it'll be very interesting to see the full breadth of what people even want. In terms of how many people, is it the 30 people? I mean, at what point do you stop going after people's phones? And the prosecutor and the grand jurors have a huge task here not to get outside of their lane of what's reasonable to ask for.
Yeah, because that was my question, Jen, is like, you know, when we're doing over here, we talked about this on a show not too long ago, where you and I talked about the minimization, because if it's not relevant to the case you're investigating, you can't listen to it, or it's not relevant to anything that the case, basically, right? And so in this instance, even if they're overhearing other potential criminal activities, you know, or suspected criminal activities, whether it's alcohol drinking or drug use or something like that, isn't it? I know you're saying, because again, I'm trying to understand this grand jury process, because again, we didn't deal with it when recruiting spies. Doesn't the prosecutor themselves, though, aren't they the ones making the call on what they're going to actually prosecute or not prosecute? So even if the grand jury found something here, it's still up to the prosecutor whether they're going to move forward with it, yes or no?
100%.
Right.
It's totally up to them, and they're going to truly understand the parameters here in terms of what they're really looking at. What they're looking at is this case. Does anybody have information that could incriminate somebody in the death of Nolan Wells? That's what everybody wants to know. And so if in that process, though, you find something that is criminal in nature, it's open. It's open for discussion. So the prosecutor, you just hope, makes a reasonable call when it comes to all the information they could potentially be seeing.
Right. Is it worth it? Is it something that's ever done by a prosecutor to say, look, we don't care about you smoking weed or drinking on your phone, if you're like, whatever. I mean, if there's something beyond that, if you got like whatever that goes, you know, beyond this bar, we're probably going to catch it. But I mean, is it worth saying, look, we're not going to be going after anybody for these sort of things. We need information about what happened to Nolan. We don't care if, you know, you got a Malibu and Coke and there's a picture of it. Is that something that's ever done, or is that just creating way too gray of an area that legally would be a mess?
It's gray. It's really gray, and legally I think would be a mess. And And sometimes, and I'm not kidding, I'm bringing this up because this is something that many people know about, is you can expose a bigot. You can expose an anti-Semite. You could see inwards. I mean, imagine the potential of all of this and why people are going to be concerned. But what they need to do with the subpoenas is be very limiting. In other words, just subpoenas that have to do with, or subpoena information that has to do with what happened July 4th. Mm-hmm. Say it's 6 a.m. or maybe the night before, maybe you give it the 3rd to the 4th, and then that's it. And you limit just that information that gets turned over. And that, you know, by doing that, I think you really set a proper limit, and a limit that's going to be approved.
I want to ask you one more thing on this case. Obviously, the independent autopsy, that information has come out this week. We still don't know about what came out of the state's autopsy. That's still behind closed doors as of our recording here. The state retained Nolan Wells' throat, trachea, hyoid bone, part of the lingual cartilage during the first autopsy. The independent pathologist says that is standard when there's concern about compression. So 19 days later, the state hasn't released what they have found. Is that info waiting for a grand jury for further testing or their evaluation, or is it going to be released to the public? What's your take on the fact that that is still being held back and we don't have an answer on it as of this moment? Is it anything, because I don't know, is it of any concern, or is it just part of the process which is going to take some time?
It's part of the process that's going to take time. And I can tell you, they were really smart with this grand jury move, because not all cases get a grand jury, right? They don't decide to utilize the grand jury, and they have here. And in doing that, they don't even have to ask for any gag orders or anything, because they know that they aren't going to release anything to the public before it's going to be seen before the grand jury. Mm-hmm. So you see this kind of cushion that they have in between them to isolate all this information from the public. It's going to go to the grand jury first. And until the grand jury receives it and has a chance to digest it and make some sort of conclusions, I don't think we're going to get anything more from the prosecution.
Yeah, I saw that this morning on the research I was doing, was that, nothing from the autopsies from the government is going to be released prior to the grand jury. It's going straight to the grand jury, like you said, Jen. And also, I generally know the prosecutor is very unlikely to pursue minor unrelated offenses like underage drinking or anything like that, because they're going to be very specific with the grand jury's instructions.
Very unlikely, but if you're the teenager and you got a scholarship or you got whatever, and that could ruin your next.
Oh, yeah. Fear is always a great motivator.
I mean, I don't know that, I mean, maybe is inspiring enough to get someone to hand over things without a subpoena. I don't know. I mean, to each their own, probably depending on what's all in there. But, I mean, hell, even if you don't have anything, you know, so you don't want to, like, even be included in a circle where somebody might think there is. So hopefully they're able to get the information they need and get the answers that are wanted, wherever this may lead. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we continue to follow this case. We will continue to follow it wherever it may lead. Let's move over to another conversation. We haven't talked about this for a few days. Nancy Guthrie has been missing from her Tucson home for nearly 6 months. No suspect name, no arrest. And 2 days ago, former FBI agent went on camera and said out loud what nobody in an official capacity has been willing to say. The case is completely cold. He's a former FBI agent, just like Jennifer Coffendaffer, who is with us, and Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent. What's your guys' take? Jen, I'm going to start with you. Is Steve Wright, is this case completely cold, as he said to Brian Anton the other day, Jen? Has the train derailed? Robin, how about you? What's your take on it? Do you think that this case is completely cold? We have not had any sort of updates in any sort of official capacity. I don't know in how long. That doesn't necessarily mean there's not things going on in the background, though. Robin, what's your take?
Yeah, it's anytime you see a former agent saying it's completely cold or not cold, that they aren't currently in, I always approach that with a good dose of maybe. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, though, I'm leaning towards there's not a lot of momentum is a good way to put it. I think there's a lot of waiting for returns on. I think still they're still waiting on DNA, I think.
Yeah.
And that's why we're in a real gray area of we think there's something going on, like research in certain areas or not. But on the large scale investigation, there's not a lot to be done right now, I wouldn't think, because who else are you going to interview? Because so if you look at it, what else could be going on? Digital forensic, you know, analysis. Well, if we're not getting any new things in, then there's nothing more to investigate there. If there's no new leads on people calling in tips or anything, then there's no more people to interview there. I just, again, it's hard to judge it because if we're not seeing it in the public venue, then is there more going on? I personally don't think there's a whole lot going on. Do I think it's cold? No, but do I think there's a lot of momentum? Definitely not. It's kind of a, this just case such as a shit show.
If there was things going on behind the scenes, if there was momentum, if there was, you know, traction being made and the plow is being moved down the field like Jeremy Clarkson on the farm. So I've become addicted to as well.
It's a good one, isn't it?
What would we be seeing right now in the public? Would we be seeing anything? Obviously, the FBI, they're going to keep everything very close to the vest until anything actually comes out. We've had a lot of leakage, allegedly from a lot of people, from this person has this person is that source, and the other person has that other source, and they're all saying different things. So I don't know how reliable that leakage even is. But what would we be seeing if they're making solid strides here?
I would think we'd see leakage with new information. Go ahead.
Oh, Jen's back. Okay.
Yeah, Jen, go ahead, Jen.
You go, talk. Jen.
The train is back on the track. Hey, listen, but I think the comments by that agent, with all due respect, and I think that is off the track. I'm just going to be crystal clear why I think that. Cold, the definition of a cold case is when you have nothing left. You have no roads to go down. It's ice cold. You have nothing, and it goes on the cold case shelf. That's what happens to it. You don't work it anymore. It goes in what we call in the FBI pending and active. That's mm-hmm. literally what we rename it from, yep. an active case. So that isn't what we have here. Listen to all these roads that still need to be gone down. We still have no answers, and I know they're still pursuing this. This I have firsthand knowledge of.
Okay.
They are pursuing the road of the IP address connected to those first two notes. They are still pursuing those notes that went into the media sources, the local media sources, and the one note that went to TMZ as well. So that isn't a dead end. It's just an inroad that is taking forever to resolve. There still is the Bitcoin that we can't just forget about. That is still being looked at by the leading nation cryptocurrency Bitcoin wallet openers. Like, that is what they do, and that's what they're going to be doing. Also, we haven't even talked about the 10,000 leads. I mean, just make yourself a to-do list and put 10 things on it a day. How long is it going to take? Now they're down to about 24 agents on that squad and, you know, maybe a half a dozen working this fairly full-time. We don't even know all those leads that might be in there that have been triaged, that they're still following up on. I think there is still so much to do. And then, of course, we know about the DNA and all of that, but I think there's so much going on behind the scenes and from being in those shoes, and it depends on each agent's background. I know his background is a pilot and CT, and which is great, but being in that war room and working these violent crime cases, there's a lot of roads I think they're going down.
How much longer do you think it's going to be for the you know, basically tempo-wise for like the IP checks and the crypto checks? Because that's a real unknown area, because that stuff wasn't going on when I was still in. That's more relatively new. Any idea on the tempo of that? And I get the 10,000 leads and 10,000, you know, more interviews to do. That takes time, and it's laborious, and trying to track down people that call that stuff in, it takes a lot of time, especially if you have limited number of agents doing those things, and it's a collateral duty to do those things. But what about the electronic stuff, Jen?
You know, I think it's going to take a long time, because obviously all they're hitting are dead ends. You know, they're just hitting dead end after dead end. And I think it's going to be similar, although it's taking much longer, to the situation with Porch Guy when his face was revealed on those videos. And it was a big aha moment on day 10, right? I think that that's what we're going to see. Quiet, quiet, quiet. And then a huge aha moment with maybe even somebody that comes forward as to Porch Guy's, you know, identity. There's another agent that's talked a lot about this case, and she has said that, oh, it's red hot and they're about to basically arrest Porch Guy. So, you know, there's so many opinions out there. My opinions are definitely based on working the cases and historical knowledge on these kinds of cases and just how long they take. So not insider source information per se.
Let me ask you about that.
They just take a long time.
Because so many, I mean, there's a ton of people reporting on this. A ton of people have their inside source with the FBI that they anonymously report what they think they're getting. And we have a lot of really good reporters out there, that it's not just, you know, some of these grifters that are out there. I mean, there's some really solid lifelong reporters that have their inside sources, and it's seemingly they're all saying different things. That number one, that's leakage that's going on, that obviously shouldn't be, but is. But you have this many different, opinions coming out of these, you know, quote unquote sources from inside the actual FBI. How does that read to you, Jen? I mean, what does that tell you when that's going on in a case like this?
Well, you know, and I know Robin and I have talked about it on your show before. It's so disheartening to us, I think, because it's unfathomable to think that anyone with real knowledge on this case is saying anything of any importance. And it's really disheartening if that's truly happening. I really just don't think that's happening. I think it's several steps removed. And that's why, you know, one source says the notes are fake. Another source says the notes are real. Mm-hmm. Another source says, you know, this is, I mean, we've heard it all, haven't we? The case is about to be solved. Another one says it's ice cold. I mean, it's so ridiculous, the differentiation of opinions on this deal. And it's because, quite frankly, no one knows, because we haven't seen the information out there. But that's why you have to go with, what does an investigation like this look like behind the scenes? And it's going to take time, or somebody recognizing Porch Guy.
So, and Jen, correct me if I'm wrong on how I see all this leakage coming. And that's why and for Tony and the audience, I go more on what Jen says on this, not because, like she said, she's there on the case, but she's got reps doing these kinds of cases. And so when I was working my cases and Jen was working the same types of space as I was, here's where you might be having leakage that could be inaccurate information. So typically, like when I was in 26 Federal Plaza in Lower Manhattan, we had, you know, you had entire floors. There was no like separate offices. There was separate cubicles for the supervisors, which their dividers went a little bit higher. But everyone, I could see six squads in one big floor. And typically, you could tell if a squad had something going on or not by the tempo of that squad, the people that are coming and going, or they're sitting at their desk. I mean, so you could tell by what's going on, if there's a lot going on, a little going on, they had a big case, not a big case, by the comings and goings, because you could see what was going on without any knowledge of exactly what was going on. And so a conjecture of mine is you could get leakage from insider sources from someone who is adjacent to a squad. You could, or they're seeing things in the office, they're seeing a tempo shift. Doesn't mean that there's not anything going on. They might have hit a different phase, like Jen's saying, a different phase of investigation, which instead of going out and interviewing 50,000 million people, they're sitting behind a desk just analyzing what's coming in, or they've removed all the information to an offsite and they're doing it there. So they're not seeing any tempo on a squad. So this could be conjecture from people if there are inside sources that are just not privy to exactly what's going on because they're not on the squad, they're adjacent to the squad. So that's just one conjecture of mine about why you're having differing opinions on all these things because they're actually not there. They're just close enough they think they know. Am I right on that, Jen?
Well, and I'll take it even one step forward or further, and I agree with you, Robin, but I think it's maybe that person then literally says something, hey, what's going on that Nancy Guthrie case to the hubby? And the hubby says, you know, it's dying down, or, oh, they've got a great lead. And then she's in the beauty shop and she's talking and, you know, everybody knows she's the wife of the agent. And, you know, that is literally how far removed this information could be.
Yep. Yep.
And that's what people run with. And it's just too many layers and not knowledge that's coming from. My understanding, and this was through CBS reporting, is there are 24 people on that squad and 12 people, I believe, that are quote unquote assigned. I believe that was their reporting.
You know
how that dribbles down because everybody sometimes can forget there's other huge cases that were going on when Nancy Guthrie's case was going on. They were on the precipice of doing warrants. They were doing a drug thing. They were doing, you know, a violent crime case that hit ahead. And those agents can't be all working Nancy Guthrie. And that's what happened. It to me, they just sucked that all out. And there's only going to be a few officially assigned.
Absolutely.
Are you at all surprised? We had a comment asking if a vehicle has been ID'd yet. And the answer to that is no. I'm surprised at that fact that we don't even have anything. Maybe you don't have a license plate. Maybe that's blur. But I mean, it's the middle of the night. I know it's a neighborhood that it's a dark neighborhood or whatever they call it. But I mean, there are ways of coming and going out of this place where I don't know. I haven't mapped it. I haven't physically been there. So this is just pure ignorant conjecture from someone going, well, there's cameras all over the place. How is it, though? I mean, when you've looked at this closer than I think almost anyone I know, Jen, when someone asks you that question, how is it there's been no vehicle of even interest that seemingly has popped up here in this case that they're honing in on after half a year now with cameras being everywhere? There's not a ton of people on the road at that time. How is there nothing in that department?
I got to tell you, that's the most disconcerting part to me, not because I would expect them in the light pollution areas. No, but what I would do is set up and actually I'm going to put this out in a tweet with each choke point that leaves that neighborhood, follow it through to the next choke point. Because remember, we're talking at, you know, 2:30 in the morning. It's not like we're talking about rush hour, for heaven's sakes. There's only going to be so many cars that ultimately have to leave a choke point, we call them. In other words, where you have to turn left or right or go straight, and you take those choke points and you look at the cameras on those choke points. Then you go to the next one. It's a lot. It's laborious. But we have thousands of analysts, and that is exactly what they do well. They say, listen, you just take this route and analyze every choke point, who has a ring, who has a nest, get that subpoenaed, and let's get this resolved. Because at some point, they have to come out. They have to come out. They're not going through that desert.
How have they not done that by now? I mean, or have they, and they don't have anything? I don't know. I mean, unless the guys got into a hot air balloon and picked her up and went into the sky, I don't know how there's not
We've
something.
Got the hot air balloon theory just hit the Nancy Guthrie case.
There we go. There's the headline. Oh, was Nancy abducted in a hot air balloon? You know? I don't know.
Conspiracy among all the scientists. Okay, we won't even go down that road. That'll get me really sardonic in a hot minute. But no, but this is the thing with this. It is arduous work. You can't even look away for a second. I mean, you take breaks and you pause it. But you know what I mean? literally one blink of your eye, one looking away for a second means you could miss that car that went by. Right?
Yeah, but,
so it's arduous work. And I want to mention this too. And I don't know if you saw this, but this is something really bothering me, is the Cal Ripken case.
Mm.
74 years old, gunman goes into her house, abducts her at gunpoint, takes her, wants money and wants her car, starts feeling sorry for her. Like she says, I don't want my eyes bandaged because I've got claustrophobia. They take that off. They put or don't even put it on. I think just put the blindfold on. They have her gagged. They give her cigarettes. They give her food. Listen, this is the scary part. You ready? He is on camera at a Walmart. I've got the footage. Many people have it. There's a composite sketch of him. It's been since 2012. They still do not have this guy who kidnapped her. Now, he let her go after about just under 24 hours, like 23 hours and 20 minutes or something. But can you imagine in this day and age, they were smoking in there? Can you imagine the DNA-laden vehicle that they have? Still haven't solved that case. $100,000 reward still exists.
It's mind-boggling with the technology that we have. I mean, that's why it's disturbing. And I mean, nothing of any sort of revelation should be happening on a podcast or this or that to investigators here. When we're talking about the choke points on the road and all that, they have to have looked at these things by now. Nobody's like, oh, that's a good idea. Heard that on the podcast. I'm going to go down that road. I mean, they have to have done these things, haven't they? I mean,
maybe.
They have. I guarantee there's analysts looking at all of this. I think there's a huge level of frustration. I can't even imagine because what I really agreed with the agent that Brian interviewed was the level of, and Robin knows all about this too, the level of pressure that an agent is going to put on themselves. I'm telling you, whoever's working this case, they are still not sleeping at night. They are sick. They're waking up in the middle of the night going, oh, wait a minute. Maybe we should do this. Did we look at that? And then you have the administration putting, you know, their bosses putting pressure on them.
Oh, yeah.
It's a national embarrassment, really, at this point. But it's more, I think, the fact that it takes patience. It's going to take a big break. I swear, every time I get a phone call late at night, I'm like, oh, my God. They've discovered who Porch Guy is. That's my first thought.
Every time I go on Twitter or X and I see some nope, it's nothing. Every single time. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Love for you to weigh in. That's where Nancy Guthrie is sitting right now. Obviously, we will continue to follow it. Be sure to press subscribe as we continue to work our way through it. Let's talk about this case. Lindsay Clancy's jury is now seated. 18 people who now have to answer one question nobody agrees on. Was a mother who was on 13 psychiatric medications criminally responsible when she killed her three children? Both sides agree she did it. That's not the debate. The fight is over whether she was sane. Jennifer Coffendaffer, retired FBI special agent, joins myself and retired FBI special agent Robin Drake. I want to start here because I know, Jen, we have somewhat differing opinions on this, but I want to kind of understand how a jury is going to get anywhere with this, especially 18 people. Prosecution thinks it's super simple. She checked Apple Maps to calculate how long her husband would be gone and allegedly strangled all three children in the window that she created, then jumped out a window and survived as part of an evil plan, completely omitting the part about begging for help countless times from countless physicians, being misprescribed, misdiagnosed over and over, and being on a cocktail of meds that would give nearly anyone who took them psychosis, with one doctor not knowing what the other is doing and failing her at every turn. Both parts are actually true in that story. Both sides seem to have people who refuse to see things from others' perspectives. It goes down to what was she thinking at that moment in time? Was it an evil conspiracy or was it a reflection of being on that many drugs? I mean, how are you going to get 18 jurors on the same page here? Do you think we do, Jen?
I think it's going to be really tough. I mean, as they say, any good attorney will tell you that the case is decided at voir dire. Yeah. That's where it's decided. It's not decided in the courtroom. And when you look at the people I want, if I want an acquittal, I am going to look for a 40 to 50-year-old woman. Mm-hmm. I want them up on that jury. I want somebody who's had postpartum, somebody who, you know, is, you know, taking whatever pills they're on to make them feel better, that the court may never know about.
Yeah.
And that's who I want on, somebody that's going to have an empathy, empathetic guy who, you know, if I'm the defense. Now, if I'm the prosecution, oh my gosh, I want that. I want guys, I want blue collar guys that think, you know, women on drugs and all of that, and that you should love your children. And then I want Catholics, I want Mormons, I want, you know, the real right side of biblical theology sort of on there. I don't know how you find that cross section that would meet, that not one person is going to sneak past on either side. What do you think?
Yeah.
You know what I think? I mean, both sides, the context of both sides are so strong. They really are. You can see both sides. And I think that is such a challenge. Like you said, you know, we've been saying the last couple of days, you know, likelihood of a hung jury is high. But you know what I think it's going to come down to is, and we, people are saying it in the comments too, just talking about the Guthrie case, it's going to come down to human beings. I think, because if you remove a lot of things from this on the science side, it's going to come down to, I think, is there congruence? Because we're always looking for congruence with the behaviors of human beings. Because if people and events and what's being reported is incongruent, it allows us to feel creepy, that there's something wrong, there's deception, there's manipulation at play. So I think it's going to really come down to her presence in the courtroom and the husband's presence in the courtroom, because they have presented, and defense is going to be presenting this narrative of a mother, caring wife, loving mother, children, I'm nurse. I mean, all these things are the arc they've painted, and how incongruent this behavior was it? And they're blaming the doctors, the prescriptions, the 13 drugs, psychotic event. So I think what the jurors are going to be looking for, what I'd be looking for is what I'm seeing in a courtroom congruent with which story? Mm-hmm. That's what they're going to be looking for. And they're going to be looking for that congruence, not just from her first, the husband, the family. You know, what are we seeing when we see her? Which story holds water based on what they are seeing? Because that's what it comes to. I know they're going to get their instructions. I know it's going to be very technical. They're going to want to follow this. But as 18 human beings look at another human being, I think they're going to look for which story is actually most congruent from what I'm being presented as a human being.
12 women, 6 men is how it plays out. That is what has been decided, and the trial is about to begin. Patrick Clancy, her husband, her ex-husband now, is on both the prosecution and the defense witness list, and the prosecution is allegedly going to be calling him first. We'll see if they do. He's the one who's also filed a malpractice lawsuit against her doctors, told a reporter he wasn't married to a monster. He was married to a woman who got sick and publicly forgave her. I mean, how does calling him first not blow up in the prosecution's face? Why do you think they're calling him first, Jen?
Oh, I want to always call that problem witness first. I don't want to have the defense do it. I want to put it out there that, listen, I know about this. We know that, you know, his thoughts on this that don't align necessarily with ours. And you get him up and you get him out as quick as you can. You limit your examination so that the defense is limited. And you move on, and then you cover that scab. I'll just say, not that he's a scab, but, you know, in your prosecution, you cover that up then with all the other information. In other words, that becomes a memory in the past. I'd put him on probably number 2 or something like that. 3, he's not my, you know, he's not my opening hitter. I don't want that. Mm-hmm. But I need to bury him somewhere between 2 and 3 or so, and then have a lot of witnesses after him.
It's also interesting, too. I'd be curious what both Eric Faddis and Bob Mata say about this as attorneys. As a human behavior guy, if they're putting on first, what I'd be hopeful as a reason why they do it is that if he's likable, if he's believable, if he's compelling, he can actually potentially set up 18 people for their positive confirmation bias for whatever comes next as well.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to have to really watch how they question him and how they go through it. I mean, that's going to be a big part of this, because this is such a personal story to people.
Yeah.
And this is something where the stakes are so high and such horrendous things happened here. Three children are not with us because of this. So that's going to be key, the approach. You're going to have to be a likable DA on this. You're going to have to be a very likable person on the prosecution if you're going to want that jury to go along with you. Same with the defense. I mean, it's going to have to not be any, you know, you don't want to be operating out of a crematorium, to put it nicely. It's not going to fly. She was prescribed 13 different psychiatric medications in 4 months. Zoloft, Prozac, Klonopin, Seroquel, Valium, Ambien, just to name a few of tasting the rainbow. Her husband told the doctors she turned into a zombie. If the medical system threw that many drugs at her and she broke, does the prosecution just pretend the medications don't matter? I mean, Jen, how do they tell this story and omit one of the most important parts to it? Or how do they downplay that as if it doesn't matter? I mean, how do you think they're going to try and do that to get a jury to not see 13 different meds in 4 months as the clear reason her brain broke?
Well, I think you got to look at the fact. You can be prescribed 13 meds, but what were you really taking? What were you
13
really
meds.
Mixing? Were you, did you try one? did anybody do, as far as I know, no one did any sort of tox on her. So there's no tox, there's no blood tox, there's nothing. All you have is somebody that was prescribed 13 meds, but nobody knows what was in her when she did that, to my knowledge. Nobody did tox on her.
Fair
so
point.
When you so have it's, that yeah, fact,
it's the
that
absence
could be,
of
yeah, she tried
yeah,
this
yeah,
one. And,
yeah. Going yeah. So basically,
that's
from a prosecution standpoint, go with the absence of information if they don't have it. And that's a big if. If that's not available, that is a big if. That could, because you got to prove it is. It's up to the prosecution in this case to prove that she was not in her right mind. That's the burden that falls on them in this, the way this case is set up. So that I could see that being a boon. Robin, what are your thoughts?
Well, and to creative Chaosify, I think I finally got her name right. And Siobhan covered it this week as well. You know, with the 13 meds, that's one angle of it. But Siobhan Scott covered it as our psychotherapist as well. You know, this actually, psychotic breaks like this is also genetic and runs in families. And so I think you have the medical side from the toxicology side from all the different meds and doctors not talking to each other and communicating like they're supposed to be doing. So that's one angle that fell off. So whether they can prove she took the meds or not, the protocols weren't followed to actually keep her safe from herself and those things. Plus, I think you have, and that's what will come out in the trial, is the fact of the other medical side is it's a family history potentially of the genetic side of the psychotic break that happened. Because according to what I was getting from Siobhan the other day, this psychotic break could have happened regardless of the meds, because she is already suffering from postpartum from the other child, you know, that she had earlier. And so having a psychotic break postpartum, I can't remember all the technical terms on this, but it could be completely irrespective of the meds that she was on. It still could have happened regardless. So I think that's what they're going to be hanging it on as well.
It'll be interesting.
I wanted to mention too, I was trying to think of how many cases and think of being correct.
Oh, she left us hanging.
I think she's the mountains of Transylvania are just going by Dracula's castle right now, and it's not. Oh, was that? Did we just lose her?
We lost her. Yep, she's gone.
Oh, she went through the tunnel.
The tunnel. Yeah, I'm not kidding. She's on a train over there. Like, why? I don't know.
I thought last week in Germany was pretty interesting, and then this week it was.
It's like Coffin Daffer world tour this week, I guess.
Are you back, Jen? Are you there?
Yeah, I am. I was just going to say, these people can't plan. at least when I've seen them. I know everybody's different, and I think that's going to be the main thing the prosecution hangs their hat on. I do agree with Robin. It's going to be a big, you know, looking at the humanity side of it, looking at how they're acting. But the other thing is, can they show the planning? Can they show text messages? Can they show, if they can show planning, that really puts a huge hole in, you know, this psychotic break that she just went after him. No, because she planned it. And I think that is where the prosecution could win this case.
But someone can be in an active psychosis for days, for weeks, for months, and cognitively plan shit. That doesn't, it doesn't mean like, snap, and now I'm completely delusional and acting like a crazy lunatic monster. That what you're describing is, could very easily be someone who is suffering from active psychosis for a period of time. That doesn't negate it out.
Yeah, it's going to be up to the defense.
Well, and that's where the experts are going to come in.
Yeah. It's after the children.
The psychologists and psychiatrists.
Yeah, yeah, and just seeing how well they can educate a jury on it, and seeing how they're gonna take it. After the children died, she was intubated in a hospital bed and used an erasable whiteboard to write the words "Do I need a lawyer?" That's another thing that we're gonna see the prosecution, I'm sure, bring up. In understanding a psychotic break or psychosis or someone suffering in and out of it. It is. You do go in and out of it. Understanding it doesn't make that in like a horrible, premeditated, I know exactly what I'm doing sort of thing. It's just kind of par for the course of someone that's going through something that horrible. I mean, could it look like someone who's premeditated something? Sure. But when you have all the evidence of other things going on and all the meds going on, I, it's about educating the jury and seeing what they will accept and what they won't accept. But how do you think that will read in general, Jen?
Well, I think it's critical that whoever has the best expert when it comes to the psychotic break, that is going to be probably who wins the day. That, to me, and the fact they can show the steps that were taken before, during, and after. And by the way, I'm sorry, the hospitalization took place exactly right after.
Mm-hmm.
If it took place exactly right after, they should have a full toxicology on exactly what she had in her at the time.
Well, I mean, that could be, if there wasn't much, it could be damning if they're going to go down the road of medications. But if they do have it and it's just a cacophony of everything, I mean, that may also save the day. So you're right. They probably should have it. But it's going to depend on what they tested for, too. Did they test for every, you know, and what shows up in that window? What did they do at that moment? So that will be key. And we just don't know the answer at this moment in time. Robin, your thoughts?
Yeah. You know, I just keep looking at, I always look at intent on things. And again, I always focus on behavior arcs, and her behavior arc prior to this event is so solid. It's so congruent. And then it begs the question for me that I think prosecution, even if, and I think defense is going to have to do this, get the expert psychiatrist up there and say how psychotic breaks can span periods of time. They can look normal. We're having people comment on it. We're commenting on it. It's not just like there are going to be a psychotic break for like 20 minutes. No, this could go on for a couple of days. That's what they're going to have to explain. But also part of this is, what could she possibly have gained if she was in her right mind by killing her kids? Literally, I mean, so when you're looking at all these cases we cover, it's like, you know, you can always look back to the motivation. They're going for insurance money. They're going because of the jilted lover. They're going because they're going for child custody issues. There's all these different things that they can show intent. Other than them saying that, you know, the prosecution saying she showed pre-planning, for what outcome? Literally, what outcome other than a psychotic break could she possibly? And that's why I think they're going to have to answer to, because me as a human being sitting on this, if she's congruent in that courtroom with someone who had a psychotic break, who has a lot of remorse, who's willing to own up to what she did, and the husband's able to be congruent too, the other argument that I, in my mind, they have to overcome is, what would be the intent of this? I mean, you know, it's not like she's going to get away with it. Well, she wasn't trying to get away with it. And what was the gain she got from doing it? I mean, she gave no leakage from what we see of saying my life would be better without my kids. I mean, see what I mean? I mean, there's a lot to overcome, I think, when it comes to a narrative.
Yeah, I would agree. Listener question here, and I want to throw it to you, Jen, before we wrap up. Do you think she should take the stand?
Mm-hmm. That's always dicey. If I'm a prosecutor, I say, yeah, get her up there.
Yeah.
Defense, please. But as a defense attorney, there is no way I'm going to turn her loose on the stand. I still want to know. I really want to know what is in the text messaging, other communications to whatever, mom, best friend, sister, a confidant. I want to know if she ever acted burdened. In other words, we all can see what she wanted to show from the outside window pane, what was really going on inside. And I tell you, if the prosecution has information that she is, you know, hated her kids and was burdened and wanted life without them, that's going to be a big problem for the defense. That's an if.
Totally agree. And that's why we live in the world of maybe. As for what we're seeing from the outside, that's what they have to overcome. But they might have the digital evidence to say that she saw her kids as a burden. And it was for not just for the couple days prior to this thing or whatever it is. But, you know, this was spanning a period of time, maybe from the first child, you know, to the second or third. Who knows? But that's what I think is the human side that they have to overcome.
Be interesting to see if she does. I've never seen her speak. So without seeing that, I mean, the way someone reads would be extremely important to answering that question. Whether or not, you know, they could totally sell their story is a huge thing. Some people are just not that effective at doing that, even if they're completely speaking from the heart. So I don't know the answer to that either. I think we'll have to kind of weigh that as it gets a little bit closer and further into the trial. It would be fascinating. The fact that the husband and Patrick is doing it there, that does say a lot and probably will be the most powerful witness of the entire trial. But we'll see. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in and give us your thoughts as this case begins. We're going to be bringing you trial audio every single day on our podcast channels. So Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeart, wherever. Search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Press subscribe. You'll get the trial audio there. And on YouTube, you'll get our analysis of it every single day as well. So you don't want to miss that. Jennifer Coffendaffer, Break the Case wherever you get podcasts and on YouTube. Be sure to subscribe there and follow her coverage on X as well. And Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent. It's Not All About Me. It's his latest book. It's available wherever books are sold and audiobook. Go check it out and leave a review. Until next time, for Jen, for Todd, for Robin, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.